Oh my goodness. Thank you so much, Craig Downer, for speaking with me on the phone. I know, I remember it's been maybe 3 or 4 years. One of the first interviews that I did was with you. I remember so well.
Yeah, we really had good conversation. So time goes on, huh?
It does, for sure. And would you introduce yourself to people who might be new to you? I know a lot of us know you very well and been following you. You're an author, you're a wildlife ecologist, you do a lot of great things.
I try to be sort of a universal man, to be well-balanced, and as I think everyone should, but I'm particularly concerned with the world of nature and all the wonderful plants and animals to which we're related and which make life possible here on Earth. So that's why I grew up on a horse here in western Nevada and eastern California and Poco, and I did a lot of riding, and then was motivated to become a wildlife ecologist and graduated from University of California, Berkeley in ecology, and then later went on to get a graduate degree at Nevada and then studied for my PhD at both Kansas University and then later at Durham University, where I studied they sponsored me in my study of the endangered mountain or Andean tapir there in the northern Andes. So I've done a lot, but I've been a champion of the wild horses and burros all my life, and I knew Wild Horse Annie, and I've written a couple books, positive books defending the rights of the wild horses and burros, and I keep abreast of all the plans of the government, and I go out and I visit the herds and I do evaluations, I make proposals and I defend their rights. So it's just an ongoing battle because you know, the exploiters dig in their heels and they don't want to share, and they distort the truth of the matter about the horses in their natural place. So I continue that, and I continue my efforts for the mountain tapir, and I have projects. I have a nonprofit called the Andean Tapir Fund, which is now, it's dedicated to saving all of the parasitoctils of the world. That is, members of the horse, tapir, and rhino families, which are disappearing from the earth, and they have a very great role to play. And I think the wild horses have an extremely important role to play in restoring and healing the earth.
Yeah.
So,
could you explain some of the...
I've been to Australia, too.
Yeah, that's so...
I've been to Australia, too, and I've made a real effort there to... Because that's the world's largest wild horse population. They call them Brumbies.
Yeah.
And I've written and testified and tried to get justice for those animals there, even though they're not as deeply rooted as a lot of the others. They still do a lot of good and refill a lot of important ecological roles.
Mm-hmm. So could you explain some of the current situation about the Mustangs in the United States, and then maybe we can go into talking about the Brumbies and what the differences are and what maybe the similarities
okay.
might be?
Okay. Yeah, the wild horses here in the United States have been really targeted, and I've recently been going over the 2020 census figures that the Bureau of Land Management put out, and they distort things, and they will say, oh, there are these many thousands of wild horses, you know, but then they won't mention how many millions of livestock there are or big game animals. They'll just count on people being stupid and not gullible, and then they'll say, well, it's just overpopulated, so they're beyond the appropriate management level. And the appropriate management level it's a joke. It's like, you know, thousands of acres of legal land per individual wild horse and burro. And so they use a lot of deceptive and dishonorable tricks to make it sound like the wild horse and burros are destructive elements that don't belong here. And it's just outrageous. And in spite of the law called the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act, which gave them, and still does, give them principal priority within their legal herd areas, which early estimates had about 88 million acres, and now the BLM recognized 53.8 million acres. And then they brought it down to about 32 million acres, and now they only want to leave about 26.7 million acres. But then the further trick is that within those acreages, they give about 85 or more percent of the forage to the livestock. And so, in other words, it's a ganging up, it's a persecution, and they don't promote these animals positively. I mean, I'm not saying it was always this way, because it used to be that there were positive people that really wanted to make the Wild Horse and Burro Act work as it was intended, and it was unanimously passed in 1971. But millions of people are becoming aware of this situation as the general public, and they're standing up and demanding reform on the public lands. And I also want to say that it's proven that these animals, these national heritage species, are deeply rooted natives in North America, and their return here is a restoration of a badly needed native wildlife species that complements all those cloven-hoofed ruminant grazers, whether it's the wildlife like the bison and the deer, or whether it's the even complements the cattle and the sheep, because they balance out the ecosystem. They have a different digestive system called the postgastric cecal, and they have a very large cecum, one of the largest proportionally of any animal, which allows them to consume more coarse, dry vegetation, and that consequently, because they don't as thoroughly digest the vegetation as a multi-stomach animal, consequently their droppings have much more substance to them and feed the ecosystem. They enrich the soil, greatly increase the humus content. Humus is very vital to soil health and to water retention, and then reducing the tinder, the drier vegetation, too, helps mitigate or even prevent the catastrophic wildfires, which are major consideration now.
Yeah.
And what's so ironic is that throughout the world, there are nations that don't have this prejudice, that recognize this and are using wild horses to restore ecosystems and to combat global warming and basically save life on Earth.
That's
so
incredible.
There's been studies showing that the horse could be major because of its adaptability throughout the world in saving life on Earth and combating global warming. And I can give you the reference for that. It was peer-reviewed study, and they have maps, and they analyze soils and weather and everything. So anyway, I've written about that, and I think some of the links are in my articles, the one I recently wrote, Please Stop Shooting the Horses in Defense of Australia's Brumbies, that you can Google.
Thank you. Yeah, it's so important what you're talking about, and I remember you speaking about that before, too, regarding the wildfires and how the horses' stomachs work, and it's really extraordinary. compliment really to the wildlife, and yet the horses are having such a hard time, and the misconception and the lies that we hear are swallowed whole, I suppose, and it's very hard for the everyday citizen or individual. Most people are not even really fully aware of, you know, that there are wild horses. You know, a lot of people are not aware of it still.
Yeah, well, there in Canada, you have people like Ken McLeod, who grew, like myself, he pioneered descent and grew up out with the wildies, who have managed to save some of the horses there, but there is no law, no general law, national law. I think there's some regional laws, though, like your Sable Island horses, but the more you read about the horse species, the more you realize what an amazing gift it is to life on Earth, that these are like saints of the animal world, because they do so much good, and they're highly evolved, and they uplift the vibration. They're beautiful, the vibration of life. People, you know, are really inspired by their beauty and their animation when they're free and able mm-hmm. to be themselves. Mm-hmm. And in so many ways, they enhance and support their life communities or ecosystems. I'm always learning something new. Every time I go out to see them, I learn something new about these amazing animals.
Yeah.
And to say that they are misfits and don't belong just because of narrow-minded, selfish, and greedy interests and, you know, mindsets is, like, totally wrong. It's totally wrong. And we shouldn't, we who appreciate them have to learn to be more aggressive and stand up and not be bullied by these obnoxious people who try to cram their narrow-minded ways down everyone else's throat. And actually, as it turns out, I mean, the future of life will probably depend on whether we do have such courage.
Yeah, we live in some very, very strange and difficult times, for sure. And I mean, the power interests that, because I was going to ask, what's happening with these lands, other than the horses? Like, we know that there's cattle, but what other interests are going after public lands?
Well, I was just reviewing the report from the BLM, and what was it, about almost 3 million acres again last year were transferred away from the legal areas of the wild horse and burros into for other uses, and they've done that repeatedly over the years. Like, you know, that's their objective, is to undermine the place of the wild horses. And I have a reserve design project that I work on, and I have a GoFundMe. And so I get limited funds. I go out. I was just out in western Utah and throughout, crossed over Nevada. And I mainly zeroed in on two herds, but... you know, I can see what's happening, and it's worse now than ever, because there's all kinds of trespass livestock out grazing out of season all over the place, and the you know, the BLM and the Forest Service are just letting it happen because the current administration doesn't care. They're kind of enemies of nature.
Yeah.
And of the wild horses. So it's a deplorable situation, and I really hope that there'll be a major change, and that people will wake up and really put themselves into doing something new and needed, and that's urgently needed as far as lifestyle changes. We all have to do our part, you know.
Yeah, right. So what about for the situation in Australia regarding the Brumbies? How is the situation there comparably?
Well, the situation is pretty dire. You know, that's the world's largest wild horse population. We call them the Brumbies. and they have other animals. And since 1788, when the first fleet of mainly penal people that were poor people, or when from poor houses, or even criminals were set free there, they started to colonize, and they brought over, there wasn't much appreciation of the difference then of how precious the unique Australian island continent was. So they brought over all kinds of animals from Europe, like cattle and sheep and rabbits and foxes and you name it, sparrows, and tried to recreate England over there. And consequently, a lot of these animals escaped and then struggled to survive. And among them were the horses. And they established big, what they call mobs in many places, including in the Great Dividing Range, also known as the Australian Alps. And I when I was there in 2014, thanks to my host, I visited there, and I was given some really, really wonderful tours, both by the Brumby supporters and horsemen and women, and the park officials and naturalists, and I also joined the Ecological Society of Australia and gave a presentation in the form of a poster, and I had two evenings where I defended that poster, which is about many of the positive things that wild horses do that to help ecosystems. And I made the point that even though they were not deeply rooted there, they could still do a lot of positive things for life communities, including many of the native species. And at the same time, I recognized, and I thought it was very important to save the native species and the pristine ecosystems that remain, such as in certain parks and reserves. I'm certainly not opposed to that, especially being a wildlife ecologist. That's very important. So I've tried to work with these people. I met with fellow ecologists and government officials, and I proposed a solution, a fair solution, which would be to put up log and pole fences, which are special triangular fences that reach up 6 or 7 feet. And I showed them a picture of that, because they employ them in the Prior Mountain wild horse range there in southern Montana and northern Wyoming. And they do very effectively keep the wild horses out of those highland meadows, which, by the way, I don't agree with, but they do effectively keep them out. And that was because the Custer National Forest decided they didn't want them, actually contrary to the Wild Horse and Burro Act, which gave them the right to be there since they were in 71. But that's what I'm hoping, and I see that, I think that my words and stands are having some effect, as I see that other ecologists there, particularly from the Center for Compassionate Conservation at the Technical University of Sydney, which I visited. And I see there's a really good group of ecologists there, some of whom I met, who are now, they're saying the same things that I was saying. And another really interesting point is that there were large-scale extinctions in the last 100,000 years, mainly since the Aborigines arrived about 50,000 years ago, and they believe that a lot of the larger, what they call the mega herbivores, the large herbivores that forage and eat plants, like the horses, and there was, for a matter of fact, there was even a hoofed large kangaroo, and they believe that they were mainly over hunted, and there were also climate changes that caused that, but you know, hundreds of species went extinct. So the point is now they're finding in their meticulous scientific studies, ecological studies, that the horses are replacing the and the donkeys too. They have wild donkeys there too. That they're replacing the functions or the roles of those mega herbivores that went extinct. Those those larger marsupial mammals that lived there not that long ago, like the pteranodons. And I can send you an article I just read on that. I just reread it just before the program too.
So in which way is the situation similar in Australia compared with the Mustangs here in North America?
Well, let me talk about how it's dissimilar.
Okay.
Because ironically, here I'd say the chief enemy are the ranchers, the cattle mainly, and also the sheep ranchers. They're the chief enemies, always have been. And matter of fact, that's why the Wild Horse and Burro Act was passed, was to defend our remnant wild horses and burros against their chief enemies. And unfortunately, this program has been taken over by the enemies.
Yeah.
And that never should have been allowed. And that's a real black eye to America, but it can be changed. And when it just depends on us. But there in Australia, where I met with these, like in the Snowy River Equestrian Association, and they had me as their guest speaker at their annual convention there in Jindabyne in New South Wales. There, many of the, what they call the station owners, not all of them, but some of the traditional old, what we call ranchers here, are defenders of the Brumbies, whereas that's rather unusual here. There are some, but it's certainly just a minority. And so that's a difference, and they regard them there as a precious heritage, and they have a sense of loyalty to these horses. Like, hey, you know, they did so much for us; they helped us survive in this difficult continent, and we owe it to them. We don't want to just wipe them out. And they have a sense of what highly evolved beings they are, and how noble and in ways, you know, very helpful and beneficent presences. So that's a difference.
Mm-hmm.
That's a difference that you see. However, there are station owners, you know, that don't like them, but many of them do like them, and they defend them. So it's a kind of a mixed situation. Now, there in the Southern Alps, they have some very beautiful parks, like Kosciuszko, where I was, and where I was taken in on horseback by Peter Cothran, a member of Parliament, and others, and Rob Gibbs, who is a biologist for the park, and I was also in the Snowy River National Park, just to the south of Kosciuszko. That's all fairly near Canterbury, the capital. And then I was through in many places throughout Australia and outback. The annual convention of the Ecological Society of Australia was in Alice Springs, and that was really fascinating. I was able to go out from there and go down and see some of the Brumbies of the outback. And then I was in the Kimberley in Broome, and was given a fantastic tour there in the Land Rover. We went clear out to Lake Gregory, and we saw Brumbies on the way.
Wow.
And I just had a real enriching experience, and mm-hmm. we got to see so many of these animals in a real feel for the land. I learned a lot too during the week where I was attending talks and presentations there, and I met quite a few of the Aborigines as well. So I really got a feel, and I felt a real calling. And I, as I explained in my recent article, I had when the Brumby advocates asked me if I would come, you know, I was waiting for kind of I obviously have a real affinity for horses and grew up, but there were certain signs that told me this was right, that I had a calling, that I should go there, or certain dreams that I had and whatnot. So I felt that I was being called there. But it's an ongoing struggle, and we're trying to get them to do a recount because of the recent fires last year in their summer, it's our summer now, so their summer of 2019 was devastating. They had terrific fires.
Yes.
There, and you know, when I was there, one of my main points that no one denied was that in many areas of Australia, the horses could prevent catastrophic wildfires, and others pointed out that in areas where they had been greatly reduced, and that's the same thing here in North America, there's often, shortly thereafter, there are enormous wildfires that do a lot of destruction. And so, you know, they kind of like had to say, hey, well, you know, we should have listened more carefully to Craig about what he was trying to say, you know. And even though they're not the real deeply rooted ones, they play really important roles in the ecosystem. And there's been so many changes in Australia's ecosystem that sometimes it's better just to let nature restore the balance. Maybe it isn't exactly the same species, but there, at least it will be a healthy ecosystem that keeps life going on the continent there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the situation they're in. But at the same time, I say, you know, I'm certainly for preserving those pristine areas, but there's ways to do that are humane and that involve sharing. And I've outlined a plan to put up those log and pole fences that would keep them out of those sensitive habitats, and those gum trees or eucalyptus, which abound there, would be perfect logs, and they have thousands of Brumby advocates. I'm sure where there's a will, there's a way, you know, that they could retain the pristine quality of those areas. So basically, that's where I stand. And I always offer, you know, to work with them as an ecologist, and maybe I can get some support to go down and do an evaluation there, a professional evaluation.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I mean, what we're seeing with the Brumbies being shot and all of this is, it's really horrific. I was just reading something again about, you mentioned that the recount that's needed because of the wildfires.
They hadn't done a recount since that fire in many of those areas. They should be doing recounts and reevaluation. Now, there's a certain doctor there with a university there in who seems really to go after them. He and his team have presented a very inflated number that they claim are inhabiting those southern Alps, which, you know, it seems just like an outrageous inflation, because they went from, you know, just 4,000 or several thousand, just jumped right up to 25,000 in spite of the fires and everything. So it seems like, you know, people, I've talked to other equine scientists, and who have evaluated that situation and been there, and they say, you know, something is not right here.
Yeah.
They just, you know, how could they have taken such an enormous jump in population in spite of everything that's happened? So what we're asking for is a recount, and particularly around their areas. It seems like some of the officials are listening to some degree, and some of the people on committees, and now I think they're doing a rethink. I sure hope so. And they won't just go out and massacre them, because imagine if the number they're presenting is like three or four times the actual number.
Yeah.
And then they go out with the mandate to take so many, and they'll end up getting them all, you know. There'll be hardly anything left, and that would be such a tragedy, you know. I just think there's this tunnel vision kind of compassionless attitude by some people that, you know, and I told them, there's quite a lively comment on my article on please stop shooting the horses in defense of Australia's Brumbies. Some people, you know, say, Craig, you should understand that we have to get rid of these non-native species. I say, well, the horse is a citizen of the world. It's an ancient presence here. And there's always change. Change always occurring in life, especially with all the major changes humans have wrought upon the planet. And I said, how would you like it if some alien, supercilious alien race came down in their flying saucers and decided that you didn't belong, you know, that they were going to restore the Aborigines there in Australia and take you out of the picture? It'll be very similar. How would you like it? Would you have any compassion, man, more compassion, if thinking of it that way?
And horses obviously come from a wild background. Humans have domesticated them over the years, so it would make sense that they return to the wild quite great, like,
yeah,
awesomely.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Jenny, because they're not that changed, actually. People mm-hmm. have studied the horses. They're not as altered as a lot of other domesticated species, which even they themselves, you know, like, they could also rewild.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the secret, is that we have to allow species to go back to their natural place and restore their natural balance, and then learn to live in harmony as part of that balance. Otherwise, we are the misfits, you know? We humans are the misfits here.
Yeah.
If we don't recognize that these species are much more natural than they are human created, to me, that's an egotistical assertion, to say that humans created these species. That overlooks all the great, you know, wisdom and knowledge that thinkers and paleontologists and people that have really dedicated their lives to learning what really happened or what really happens with life and all our interconnections and our history, you know, it ignores them. And I just think that's extremely wrong. Now, there's something going on there in Australia which is kind of unusual, as I say. It's a bit distinct from here. A lot of the ones that defend the Brumbies will lash out against what they call the greenies, you know, the ecologists and conservationists, environmentalists. In other words, they're more on the traditional side. And, I say, wait a minute, you know, I think they have a lot of good points too. We all have good points. The Aborigines have wonderful contributions to make too. They have been there, one of the most ancient races of people on the earth, and they've been there about 50 thousand years, and they would have a lot of contributions to make. The people that are the so-called greenies too would, and the traditional people who've lived close to the land too, and value just living there and being part of things, and have a lot of know-how, and just like the horses, they've struggled too to survive. So I say, let's pull in our horns here and have some respect for one another and where we come from, our own unique backgrounds, and why we are, why we represent what we do. And let's learn to listen to each other and to reach a harmonious agreement for the good of everybody, and not be so arrogant and you know, my way or the highway attitudes. I think that's the way forward, and I hope that I've made some little but significant contribution, mm-hmm. maybe even a big one in that respect, and by being a person who came in and was very taken with Australia. I think it's a marvelous place, and as I say, I felt that I had a calling to go there.
Yes.
And a reason.
Yeah, you definitely. I'm so glad that you were able to make that trip and connect also like equine advocates across the world, because as living in North America, following some of the situation in Australia about the Brumbies, something that I noticed too is, you know, how very active they are, and that they were trying to actually lead some of these horses off of the land itself to bring them to private lands and things like that. Like, it was really extraordinary and devastating to know that, you know, these horses are at risk, and how the governments are trying to solve these situations. I'm not sure that they're listening to, like, what you're talking about, thinking about wildlife and thinking about protecting Earth. It seems like there's a lot of lobbying going around, and private interests, and not necessarily long-term positive for the environment type of interests.
Yeah, there's been a lot of exploitation of the resources there, but there are some very dedicated conservationists and ecologists that really appreciate that, and they zero in on the original pre-white fauna and flora. But as I say, when you actually start studying the ancient history of that island continent, you see there are connections. And I pointed out, you know, I said, you know, there were wild horses in South America, and they lived for millions of years with a lot of marsupials, because South America and all that great Gondwana land, that southern landmass, was all connected at one time. And there's, you know, the southern beaches were there, and the possums, and there were, you know, there's emus also. I saw some really delightful emus there. And when I was in those parks, you know, doing those tours, I was there for about a week. I stayed as a guest there in Jindabyne, but made excursions every day into the parks. And then I was also camped up, before that, I was camped up in Kosciuszko near the reservoirs, and made excursions every day. But when I was there and traveling around and saw the Brumbies there, practically everywhere seemed quite healthy in those parks. But then the park biologist, Gibbs, took me up there along with a few others, you know, and showed me these highland marshy areas, these highland meadows where there were Brumbies, and yes, they were coming in to drink, and in a few places they were rolling, but I mean, it wasn't like a devastated place. There was some minor degree of creek bank sloughing, and there were some bare areas where they congregate, but most of it had a healthy meadow there. So I think we have to beware And as I said, I saw exuberant native wildlife. I saw the kookaburra, which was just an incredible bird, like a magical bird. That laugh was too much. But and then I saw the emus, you know, the flocks of emus running around, and the kangaroos and the wallabies and the wombats and the koalas and all of them. They were there, and things seemed very harmonious to me. So it seems to me that they're going out of the way to target the wild horses,
yeah,
and lay blame upon them. Rather, and there are some various serious effects that people are having there. For example, building the huge reservoirs and siphoning the water down to the metropolis areas or the farms or whatever. So let's be really objective about this. Let's not just pick out one to scapegoat and blame and not take responsibility for what we can do, and then ignore, you know, how we could solve this, and also ignore, we shouldn't ignore all the positive things they do, like replacing the roles of those animals that seeded the plants that helped mitigate wildfire and things like that.
Yeah, right now we live in what seems to be an environmental crisis. We have pretty extreme weather. All of this we've been learning and reading about for so many years, and now we live in a climate that is getting worse. We have so many catastrophic.
Oh, no, it's a scary situation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more important than any war, any silly war that's ever been fought. This is truly a life and death matter. And I joined the Sunrise Movement, and, you know, Greta Thunberg, she's my hero. What a wonderful lady. She's like a Joan of Arc. And here where I live, we had a big at South Lake Tahoe, just over, just near where I live. We had a big, it was part of the climate strike on September the 20th. And there were hundreds of mainly high school students that came and really gave impassioned, several of them gave really impassioned speeches about how serious the situation is and how we really got to get our act together now, because it's now or never, and we just have to address these very serious issues.
For sure. What advice do you have for other groups trying to protect their wild horses?
Well, I would say try to give the horses as natural and free a life as possible, and be very careful to try and restore the genetic diversity and the natural adaptability, because a lot of this controlled breeding and interference will cause serious problems for the horses as far as their future survival. And right, because of the selected breeding of just certain stallions, the male heterogeneity of the genetic material is really threatened.
Yeah.
So there should be more stallions, different stallions, and, you know, and I just say in general, try and incorporate them with your local, incorporate them into your local natural ecosystem, as they're doing in so many places around the world, because they recognize that they do restore and enhance ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. What about the general public? How can the general public help with mustangs and brumbies?
Okay, I'd say become involved. There's some really good groups now. They can contact me. I have a nonprofit called the Andean Taper Fund, and a branch of that is called the Wild Horse and Burro Fund. And I have the reserve design proposal, which is a GoFundMe. So call up my website, which is thewildhorseconspiracy.org, and or call up AndeanTaperFund.com. And there are all the links. and I have several recommended organizations that are really fighting the good fight too. And there are groups in Australia too, like Equine Voice of Australia and Save the Brumbies and the Snowy River Equestrian Association. There are many really good groups, but I'd be glad to give you a list of those if you want to contact me through my website. All my contacts are there. And I have some, you know, depending on exactly what you're willing to do. But I think we just have to become much more engaged and much more serious and not letting people that are prejudiced and that are scapegoating these animals get away with their distortions and their twisting of the truth, you know, and their filtering and actually just a lot of it just outright malicious. They issue lies against them, and it's just not right. We have to have the courage to stand up. So become involved, become aware of the horses, like Ken McLeod there in Canada, you know. He grew up with wild horses and become aware, and then he took a stand and he got proposals through to protect the horses in various areas. Become aware and go out and visit these horses and then give input to the government on their plans. And if their plans are unfair, then protest them and get action to counter these plans. Don't just let a relative handful of benighted, selfish people steal the show, because they will. Mm-hmm. If you let them. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to take courage, you know, and it's all related. And the wild horse issue is not just a minor insignificant issue, like they don't matter. That's very false. The presence of the horse is all those equids and other parasodactyls, but is very important. I feel that the horse today is kind of like a savior, though. There's something really special and very compelling about its cause and doing justice to these wonderful animals. Remember, we wouldn't be in our position of so-called dominance and affluence if it weren't for the horses.
Right.
Yet the horse is from nature. It's one of the most ancient presences here, and the fossil record and genetics shows how long it's been here, and its cradle of evolution is right here in North America, and then it spread out throughout many places throughout the world where it played a major role. So there's something really special, and there's a real special relationship between humans and the horse. And I think the most special today is going to be their role, or is their role, to bring us back into a truly respectful and harmonious relationship with the entire ecosystem, with all the plants and animals. I think they're really special in that regard, as far as, you know, the whole planet, and it's all intertied, but they're very crucial. So I would urge people to take a real active stand, to learn more, to gain a more in-depth appreciation of them, and so that we can reform our human lifestyle in order to share the land and freedom with these magnificent animals.
That sounds amazing. You're on the right path, and I think that I agree with everything you're saying. Like, where would we be without the horses? And so even things like the mental health aspects that horses add to our lives, you know, like there's so many answers that we can find.
There are millions of people who don't have vested no interest in exploiting the lands and squeezing every last drop of blood out of desert land, for example. Millions of people, they just say, hey, they see the wild horses, they hear them, they experience them. They're just thrilled. They're just like really inspired. They say, wow, this made me feel so alive. These animals are so alive. They're so, you know, beautiful. And I've just heard so many people over the years, they just, once they go in and open their eyes and their ears and their senses and their minds and hearts, they understand, you know, they understand why it's important.
Yeah.
And why they're so important.
There's a question here, because we're doing a Facebook Live at the moment as well, and there's a question to you from Nita Ryan. And the question is,
yeah?
Why is PZP not a good solution?
Well, I've looked into PZP, and I'm very concerned about its adverse effects. You go in and you coat the eggs with ground up pig's ovaries, and in order to inhibit the sperm from penetrating them, and so right there you create a domesticated animal, and your people are taking the place of natural selection. And studying into it and reading the various observations of the equine scientists and zoologists and ecologists that have observed things is that it causes social disruption because the natural cycles are not completed, so there's frustration. So horses are very social animals.
Yeah.
And to survive out in the wild, you really got to have your act together as a group. And so if there's frustration and the mare feels unfulfilled in life and rejects the stallions are frustrated and they have a lot of angst. And I've seen that because I've been out to the McCullough Peaks herd in Wyoming, and I've been up to the Pryor Mountains and in quite a few areas here in the Virginia Range where they are, and the herds become kind of morose and downcast, and they don't function as well. They're not their ability to survive. And another thing is that the mares that it works the best on are the ones that have the strongest immune system. So they're the ones that are not reproducing. On the other hand, the mares that have the weakest immune system, PZP works the least on. So they're the ones that are producing more. Consequently, after a few to several generations, you're creating a herd that has a very weak immune system, and that sets it up for decline or demise, and that's very serious. And that this is from the scientists who have observed them and analyzed the situation. So that's why I don't agree with PZP, and why I present reserve design as the way to establish genetically viable, number one, populations and habitats, like the law really said to do, and ecologically well-adapted, let the horses adapt to each special area that is their legal home, and design a reserve with natural boundaries, or where necessary, you can put in those, like those log and pole fences or whatever, which, by the way, permit other animals to pass through. And they would become naturally self-stabilizing once they fill their niche. And what I'm discovering in analyzing these statistics is that they're not allowing, they're claiming the horses are overpopulated, but I don't see an area where where they are overpopulated. If you do the math and you divide their present populations, even the what could be considerably fudged, over-magnified, you divide that into their legal acreage, it comes out to a figure that is not excessive. Even in a semi-arid desert area, it's not over the carrying capacity. So basically, my studies have shown that when the horses, which are what they call a climax species, fill their niche, they self-stabilize their numbers. They don't reproduce as much. And another key to this process is allowing them to have their well-functioning, mature social units, their bands, and their and the groups of bands which are known as herds. When they're mature, when you have mature stallions and mares, they inhibit the reproduction of the sub juveniles, the sub-mature ones, and that works to prevent over reproduction, overpopulation. And then too, as the different bands partition their home ranges in a vast area, that kind of evens out, and as the resources are used or taken up by these different bands, the horses don't produce as much. The mares don't conceive, and that's been shown.
Yeah.
And a lot of other animals are like that too, and that's why that's something I learned early on as a student of ecology at Berkeley, is that there are these climax species, and that the horse is one of them.
Yeah. Craig, you know what? We're at the very
self-limiting.
Thank you so much for this awesome conversation. We're at the end of our hour here. Please stay in touch with me. I'm going to contact you after as well, because I'm really interested in the articles that you have spoken about. And
Okay, sure.
All right.
That'd be great. Well, thanks so much for having me on, Jennifer. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon, okay?
Okay.
Bye, Craig. Bye. And with that, we are going to sign out. We are going to sign out of Blue Sky Horse Radio. Thanks so much for listening to CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo today.